Good morning and welcome to the Word of Life. I'm glad you've joined us this morning. We have a relatively unique program for the way that we usually do things here on the Word of Life. We're going to have a lengthy reading out of a book by a fellow named Lee Strobel. Lee, with a journalism degree from the University of Missouri and a Master of Studies in Law degree from Yale Law School, was the award-winning legal editor of the Chicago Tribune and a spiritual skeptic until about 1981. He's written books including four gold medallion winners, the 2005 Christian Book of the Year, co-authored with Gary Poole. Lee and his wife now live in California. The book that we're going to read a part of today, The Case for Christ, is a book that investigates the evidence for Jesus Christ in both inside and outside the scripture, archaeological, various things like this. What he did in these books is interview different people about different subjects of the life of Christ. And one of the interviews is with a fellow that we mentioned before on the program last Lord's Day. I told you we'd be doing this. Alexander Methril, MD, PhD, who is a forensic pathologist, I guess would be the way to describe him. And we're going to be talking about both the beatings before the cross, the things that Jesus endured leading up to the cross, and the cross itself and some of the statements about it. Now, although this will sound maybe a little different doing it this way, I want to read to you exactly the text as it appears in the book, The Case for Christ, an Alexander Methril interview. We begin that now and join us in this. The plush setting was a clear contrast with the subject we were discussing. And there we were, sitting in the living room of Methril's comfortable California home on a balmy spring evening, warm ocean breezes whispering through the windows while we were talking about a topic of unimaginable brutality, a beating so barbarous that it shocks the conscience and a form of capital punishment so depraved that it stands as wretched testimony to man's inhumanity to man. I had sought out Methril because I heard he possessed the medical and scientific credentials to explain the crucifixion, but I also had another motivation. I had been told he could discuss the topic dispassionately as well as accurately. That was important to me because I wanted the facts to speak for themselves without the hyperbole or charged language that might otherwise manipulate emotions. As you would expect from someone with a medical degree, the University of Miami in Florida, and a doctorate in engineering from the University of Bristol in England, Methril speaks with scientific precision. He is board certified in diagnosis by the American Board of Radiology and has been a consultant to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. A former research scientist who has taught at the University of California, Methril is editor of five scientific books and has written for publications ranging from Aerospace Medicine to Scientific American. His ingenious analysis of muscular contraction has been published in the Physiologist and Biophysics Journal. He even looks the role of a distinguished medical authority. He's an imposing figure with silver hair and a courteous yet formal demeanor. I'll be honest, at times I wondered what was going on inside Methril. With scientific reserve, speaking slowly and methodically, he gave no hint of inner turmoil as he calmly described the chilling details of Jesus' demise. Whatever was going on underneath, whatever distress it caused him as a Christian to talk about the cruel fate that befell Jesus, he was able to mask with a professionalism born out of decades of laboratory research. He just gave me the facts. And after all, that was what I had traveled halfway across the country to get. Initially, I wanted to elicit from Methril a basic description of the events leading up to Jesus' death. So after a time of social chat, I put down my iced tea and shifted in my chair to face him squarely. "Could you paint a picture of what happened to Jesus?" I asked. He cleared his throat. "It began after the Last Supper," he said. "Jesus went with his disciples to the Mount of Olives, specifically to the Garden of Gethsemane. And there, if you remember, he prayed all night. Now, during that process, he was anticipating the coming events of the next day. Since he knew the amount of suffering he was going to have to endure, he was quite naturally experiencing a great deal of psychological stress. I raised my hand to stop him. "Whoa, now that's where the skeptics have a field day," I told him. "The Gospels tell us he began to sweat blood at this point. Now, come on. Isn't that just a product of some overactive imagination? Doesn't that call into question the accuracy of the Gospel writers?" Unfazed, Methril shook his head. "Not at all," he replied. This is what is known medical condition called hematidrosis. It's not very common, but it is associated with a high degree of psychological stress. What happens is that in severe anxiety causes the release of chemicals that break down the capillaries in the sweat glands. As a result, there's a small amount of bleeding into these glands, and the sweat comes out tinged with blood. Now, we're not talking about a lot of blood. It's just a very, very small amount. Though a bit chastened, I pressed on. Did this have any other effects on the body? What this did was set up the skin to be extremely fragile so that when Jesus was flogged by the Roman soldier the next day, his skin would be very, very sensitive. Well, I thought, here we go. I braced myself for the grim images I knew were about to flood my mind. I'd seen plenty of dead bodies as a journalist, casualties of car accidents, fires, crime syndicate, retribution. But there was something especially unnerving in hearing about someone being intentionally brutalized by executioners determined to extract maximum suffering. "Tell me," I said, "what was the flogging like?" Methro's eyes never left me. Roman floggings were known to be terribly brutal. They usually consisted of 39 lashes, but frequently were a lot more than that, depending on the mood of the soldier applying the blows. The soldier would use a whip of braided leather thongs with metal balls woven into them. When the whip would strike the flesh, these balls would cause deep bruises or contusions, which would break open with further blows. And the whip had pieces of sharp bone as well, which would cut the flesh severely. The back would be so shredded that part of the spine was sometimes exposed by the deep, deep cuts. The whipping would have gone all the way from the shoulders down to the back, the buttocks, and the back of the legs. It was just terrible. Methro paused. "Go on," I said. One physician who has studied Roman beatings says as the flogging continued, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. A 3rd-century historian by the name of Eusebius described a flogging by saying the sufferer's veins were laid bare and the very muscles, sinews, and bowels of the victim were open to exposure. We know that many people would die from this kind of beating even before they would be crucified. At the least, the victims would experience tremendous pain and go into hypovolemic shock. Methro had thrown in a medical term I didn't know. "What does hypovolemic shock mean?" I asked. "Hypo means low. Vol refers to volume, and emic means blood. So hypovolemic shock means the person is suffering the effects of losing a large amount of blood," the doctor explained. "This does 4 things. First, the heart races to try to pump blood that isn't there. Second, the blood pressure drops, causing fainting or collapse. Third, the kidneys stop producing urine to maintain what volume is left. And fourth, the person becomes very thirsty as the body craves fluids to replace the lost blood volume." "Do you see evidence of this in the gospel accounts?" I asked. "Yes, most definitely," he replied. "Jesus was in hypovolemic shock as he staggered up the road to the execution site at Calvary, carrying the horizontal beam of the cross. Finally, Jesus collapsed, and the Roman soldier ordered Simon to carry the cross for him. Later, we read that Jesus said, 'I thirst,' at which point a sip of vinegar was offered to him. Because of the terrible effects of this beating, there's no question that Jesus was already in serious to critical condition even before the nails were driven through his hands and feet." Now, as distasteful as the description of the flogging was, I knew that even more repugnant testimony was to come. That's because historians are unanimous that Jesus survived the beating that day and went on to the cross, which is where the real issue lies. These days, when condemned criminals are strapped down and injected with poisons or secured to a wooden chair and subjected to a surge of electricity, the circumstances are highly controlled. Death comes quickly and predictably. Medical examiners carefully certify the victims passing from close proximity. Witnesses scrutinize everything from beginning to end. But how certain was death by this crude, slow, and rather inexact form of execution called crucifixion? In fact, most people aren't sure how the cross kills its victims, and without a trained medical examiner to officially attest that Jesus had died, might he have escaped the experience brutalized and bleeding, but nevertheless alive? I began to unpack these issues. What happened when he arrived at the site of the crucifixion, I ask? He would have been laid down, and his hands would have been nailed in the outstretched position to the horizontal beam. This crossbar was called a patibulum. And at this stage, it was separate from the vertical beam, which was permanently set in the ground. I was having difficulty visualizing this. I needed more details. Nailed with what, I asked? Nailed where? The Romans used spikes that were 5 to 7 inches long and tapered to a sharp point. They were driven through the wrist, Methrel said, pointing about an inch or so below his left palm. Hold it, I interrupted. I thought the nails pierced the palms. That's what all the paintings show. In fact, it's become a standard symbol representing the crucifixion. Through the wrist, Methrel repeated. This was a solid position that would lock the hands. If the nails had been driven through the palms, his weight would have caused the skin to tear and he would have fallen off the cross. So the nails went through the wrist, although this was considered part of the hand in the language of the day. And it's important to understand that the nail would go through the place where the median nerve runs. This is the largest nerve going out to the hand, and it would be crushed by the nail that was being pounded in. Now, since I only have a rudimentary knowledge of the human anatomy, I wasn't sure what this meant. What sort of pain would that produce, I asked. Let me put it this way, he replied. Do you know the kind of pain you feel when you bang your elbow and hit your funny bone? That's actually another nerve called the ulna nerve. It's extremely painful when you accidentally hit it. Well, picture taking a pair of pliers and squeezing and crushing that nerve, he said, emphasizing the word squeezing as he twisted an imaginary pair of pliers. That effect would be similar to what Jesus experienced. I winced at the image and squirmed in my chair. The pain, he continued, was absolutely unbearable. In fact, it was literally beyond words to describe. They had to invent a new word, excruciating. Literally, excruciating means out of the cross. Think of that. They needed to create a new word because there was nothing in the language that could describe the intense anguish caused during the crucifixion. At this point, Jesus was hoisted as the crossbar was attached to the vertical stake. And then nails were driven through Jesus' feet. Again, the nerves in his feet would have been crushed. And here would have been a similar type of pain. Crushed and severed nerves were certainly bad enough, but I needed to know about the effect that hanging from the cross would have had on Jesus. What stresses would this have put on his body? Methrel answered, first of all, his arms would have immediately been stretched, probably about 6 inches out, and both shoulders would have become dislocated. You can determine this with simple mathematical equations. This fulfilled the Old Testament prophecy in Psalm 22, which foretold the crucifixion hundreds of years before it took place and says, "My bones are out of joint." Methrel had made his point graphically about the pain endured as the crucifixion process began. But I needed to get to what finally claims the life of a crucifixion victim, because that's the pivotal issue in determining whether death can be faked or eluded. So I put the question, cause of death, directly to Methrel. Once a person is hanging in the vertical position, he replied, crucifixion is essentially an agonizingly slow death by asphyxiation. The reason is that the stresses on the muscles and diaphragm put the chest into the inhaled position. Basically, in order to exhale, the individual must push up on his feet so the tension on the muscles would be eased for a moment. In doing so, the nail would tear through the foot, eventually locking up against the tarsal bones. After managing to exhale, the person would then be able to relax down and take another breath in. Again, he'd have to push himself up to exhale, scraping his bloodied back across the coarse wood of the cross. This would go on and on until complete exhaustion would take over and the person wouldn't be able to push up and breathe anymore. As the person slows down his breathing, he goes into what is called respiratory acidosis. The carbon dioxide in his blood is dissolved as carbonic acid, causing the acidity of the blood to increase. This eventually leads to an irregular heartbeat. In fact, with his heart beating erratically, Jesus would have known that he was at the moment of death, which is when he was able to say, "Lord, into your hands I commit my spirit," and then he died of cardiac arrest. It was the clearest explanation I had ever heard of death by crucifixion, but Methrel wasn't done. Even before he died, and this is important too, the hypovolemic shock would have caused a sustained rapid heart rate that would have contributed to heart failure, resulting in the collection of fluid in the membrane around the heart, called a pericardial effusion, as well as around the lungs, which is called a pleural effusion. Now, why is that significant, I ask? Because of what happened when the Roman soldier came around and, being fairly certain that Jesus was dead, confirmed it by thrusting a spear into his right side. It was probably his right side. That's not certain, but from the description, it was probably the right side between the ribs. The spear apparently went through the right lung and into the heart, so that when the spear was pulled out, some fluid, the pericardial effusion and the pleural effusion, came out. This would have the appearance of a clear liquid like water, followed by a large volume of blood, as the eyewitness John described in his gospel. John probably had no idea why he saw both blood and a clear fluid come out. Certainly that's not what an untrained person like him would have anticipated. Yet John's description is consistent with what modern medicine would expect to have happened. At first, this would seem to give credibility to John being an eyewitness. However, there seemed to be one big flaw in all of this. I pulled out my Bible and flipped to John 19:34. "Wait a minute, Doc," I protested. "When you carefully read what John said, he saw blood and water come out. He intentionally put the words in that order, but according to you, the clear fluid would have come out first. So there's a significant discrepancy here." Omethyl smiled slightly. "I'm not a Greek scholar," he replied, "but according to people who are, the order of words in ancient Greek was determined not necessarily by sequence, but by prominence. This means that since there was a lot more blood than water, it would have made sense for John to mention the blood first." I conceded the point, but made a mental note to confirm it myself later. At this juncture, I said, "What would Jesus' condition have been?" Methral's gaze locked with mine. He replied with authority, "There was absolutely no doubt that Jesus was dead." Dr. Methral's assertion seemed well supported by the evidence, but there were still some details I wanted to address, as well as at least one soft spot in his account that could very well undermine the credibility of the biblical account. Now, the Gospels say, "The soldiers broke the legs of the two criminals being crucified with Jesus," I said. "Why would they have done that?" Well, if they wanted to speed up death, and with the Sabbath and Passover coming, the Jewish leaders certainly wanted to get this over with before sundown. The Romans would use the steel shaft of a short Roman spear to shatter the victim's lower leg bones. This would prevent him from pushing up with his legs so he could breathe, and death by asphyxiation would result in a matter of minutes. Of course, we're told in the New Testament that Jesus' legs were not broken, because the soldiers had already determined that he was dead, and they just used the spear to confirm it. This fulfilled another Old Testament prophecy about the Messiah, which is that his bones would remain unbroken. Again, I jumped in. "Some people have tried to cast doubt on the gospel accounts by attacking the crucifixion story," I said. "For instance, an article in the Harvard Theological Review concluded many years ago that there was, quote, astonishing little evidence that the feet of a crucified person were ever pierced by nails," unquote. Instead, the article said the victim's hands and feet were tied to the cross by ropes. "Won't you concede that this raises credibility problems with the New Testament account?" I asked. Dr. Methral moved forward until he was sitting on the edge of his chair. "No," he said, "because archaeology has now established that the use of nails was historical, although I'll certainly concede that ropes were indeed sometimes used." I asked, "What is the evidence?" In 1968, archaeologists in Jerusalem found the remains of about three dozen Jews who had died during the uprising against Rome around AD 70. One victim, whose name was Yohanan, had been crucified. And sure enough, they found a 7-inch nail still driven into his feet, with small pieces of olive wood from the cross still attached. This was excellent archaeological confirmation of a key detail in the Gospel's description of the crucifixion. Touché, I thought. But one other point of dispute concerns the expertise of the Romans to determine whether Jesus was dead, I pointed out. These people were very primitive in terms of understanding of medicine and anatomy and so forth. How do we know they weren't just mistaken when they declared that Jesus was no longer living? "Well, I'll grant you these soldiers didn't go to medical school," he said, "but remember that they were experts in killing people. That was their job, and they did it very well. They knew without a doubt when a person was dead, and really it's not so terribly difficult to figure out. Besides, if a prisoner somehow escaped, the responsible soldiers would be put to death themselves, so they had a huge incentive to make absolutely sure that each and every victim was dead when he was removed from the cross." Appealing to history and to medicine, to archaeology, and even Roman military rules, Methral had closed every loophole. Jesus could not have come down from the cross alive. But still I pushed him further. Is there any possible way that Jesus could have survived this? Methral shook his head and pointed his finger at me for emphasis. "Absolutely not," he said. "Remember that he was already in hypovolemic shock from massive blood loss before the crucifixion started. He couldn't possibly have faked his death because you cannot fake the inability to breathe for long. Besides, the spear thrust into his heart would have settled the issue once and for all, and the Romans weren't about to risk their own death by allowing him to walk away alive. So, I said, when someone suggests to you that Jesus merely fainted on the cross, he said, I tell them it's impossible. It's a fanciful theory without any possible basis in fact. Yet I wasn't ready, quite ready, to let go of the issue. At the risk of frustrating the doctor, I said, let's speculate that the impossible happened and that Jesus somehow managed to survive the crucifixion. Let's say he was able to escape from his linen wrappings, roll the huge rock away from the mouth of his tomb, and get past the Roman soldiers who were standing guard. Medically speaking, what condition would he have been in after he tracked down his disciples? Methrol was reluctant to play that game. Again, he stressed, becoming a bit more animated, there's just no way he could have survived the cross. But if he had, how would he walk around after nails had been driven through his feet? How could he have appeared on the road to Emmaus just a short time later, strolling for long distances? How could he have used his arms after they were stretched and pulled from their joints? Remember, he also had massive wounds on his back and a spear wound in his chest. Then he paused. Something clicked in his mind, and now he was ready to make a closing point that would drive a final stake through the heart of the fainting on the cross theory once and for all. It was an argument that nobody has been able to refute ever since it was first advanced by German theologian David Strauss in 1835. Listen, Methrol said, a person in that kind of pathetic condition never would have inspired his disciples to go out and proclaim that he's the Lord of life who had triumphed over the grave. Do you see what I'm saying? After suffering that horrible abuse with all the catastrophic blood loss and trauma, he would have looked so pitiful that the disciples would never have hailed him as a victorious conqueror of death. They would have felt sorry for him and tried to nurse him back to health, so it's preposterous to think that if he had appeared to them in that awful state, his followers would have been prompted to start a worldwide movement based on the hope that someday they, too, might have a resurrection body like his. There's just no way. In a few moments, we'll address that. Right now, a song. I appreciate you humoring me today and listening to the Methrol interview. I want you to understand that the physical aspects of Calvary had to be overwhelming to face. Now, there were a lot of other people crucified, but the other people that were crucified were not like Jesus. I want you to understand very clearly, and we're going to talk about this next Lord's Day to a greater degree, that what Jesus did was the only innocent adult that ever has died that day. He was carrying the load of me and the load of you. And that's something in addition to all that was going on that day that had to have had tremendous effect on Jesus. As you look then at the physical aspect of Calvary, the carnage of Calvary, we'll call it, I want you to understand clearly that this was not a pleasant thing to look forward to. Perhaps that explains the garden, doesn't it? Father, let this cup pass, but not as I will, but as you will. Although this certainly wasn't the worst aspect of Calvary, the worst aspect had to be that Jesus knew the separation from his Father that was coming. I want you to be sure and tune in to the program next week and listen to the spiritual carnage that occurred at Calvary also. And we'll continue to talk about the physical, but we're going to tie in the spiritual then. And remember that these lessons are available on the website of the ColcordChurchOfChrist.org. Make sure that you give your attention to God. This week, read those accounts again. Next week, join us, and we'll be studying the spiritual carnage of Calvary, of Jesus Christ, our Savior.